This is the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. I'm your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com, the NFL wire site from the USA Today family of sites. But we don't have my co-host on this edition of the show, episode 272. Revenge of the Bird Seth Cox is not with us in this edition of the show because we've got a special treat for you. It is the first of our three season preview shows where I have interviews with writers and editors from around the NFL wire talking about the Cardinals' 2020 opponents. We're going to cover the first 4 weeks of the season, the Cardinals' first four opponents. In week one, they've played the San Francisco 49ers on the road. Week two, the Washington football team, formerly known as the Redskins. Week three, they face the Detroit Lions and round out the first quarter of the season against the Carolina Panthers. So let's go ahead and get started with week one. We're going to kick things off with the Cardinals' first opponent of the season. They play the San Francisco 49ers in week one and then not again until week 16. But to kick off our previews, we're going to start with 49ers. And to help us with that, I've got Niners Wire's managing editor Kyle Madsen, a guy I enjoy immensely. He's a great follow on Twitter. A colleague, a guy that we have common friends slash colleagues, and but despite being a Niners guy, being a Bay Area guy, I love him to death. This is Kyle Madsen from NinersWire.com. Kyle, how's it going for you?
As good as it can be right now. I'm working, and my family's healthy, and I'm healthy. So
absolutely,
all things considered, I can't complain.
And we're hoping that week one matchup between the Cardinals and 49ers can actually happen September 13th, providing everything goes well. So what we're going to do on this segment is we talked about the 49ers, kind of preview and review. We know what the 49ers did last year, but what were the biggest successes? What were the biggest issues? Then we'll look into the offseason. Let's start off with last year, obviously, for most of us, a very surprising successful year. What led to their success, and what ultimately were the issues that caused them to lose in the Super Bowl?
So the two biggest differences between 2018 when they went 4-12 and then 2019 when they went 13-3 was added pass rush with Nick Bosa, who they drafted 2 overall, and then they traded for Dee Ford that offseason. Eric Armstead, a former first-round pick in his fifth year, finally broke out and led the team with 10 sacks. So they just put together, and then DeForest Buckner was an all-pro again. So they put together a really good defensive line that helped kind of cover up some of the holes in their secondary. They brought back basically the same secondary from the year before when they had the worst pass defense in the league. So they basically built their defense from front to back. And then the linebackers always get overlooked, but Fred Warner in his second season was really, really good. They signed Quan Alexander, who is excellent in coverage, which is so important at that position in today's NFL. And then they drafted Dre Greenlaw, fifth round out of Arkansas, kind of an overlooked prospect who wound up being a really, really good player who had to start for them when Quan Alexander got hurt, and he filled in really nicely. So they just shored up their defense from front to back. They were really good. They were healthy for the most part on that side of the ball. And then Jimmy Garoppolo was healthy. And if you have a quarterback of Jimmy Garoppolo's caliber, I think he's kind of a middle top 15, 16 guy. It's in that range. And if you have that caliber of quarterback in Kyle Shanahan's offense, you're getting a lot of points. And they did that. So Garoppolo's health and the pass rush, I think, were the two biggest keys.
What were their biggest weaknesses? Obviously, they kind of rolled through their schedule all year. It was kind of a – I remember is that everyone – no one really believed until the 49ers until they made it to the playoffs, and they're like, oh, guess I'm going to believe in him. Because I think it was a case where no one really believed that Jimmy Garoppolo could be a Super Bowl-leading quarterback, and he was better than advertised. But were there any concerns that came up down the stretch?
Yeah, the receiving core was definitely an issue. It's why they unloaded a third round pick and a fourth round pick in the middle of the season for Emmanuel Sanders. They needed help badly in that area. So they went out and they got Emmanuel Sanders, and that shored up their receiving core for last year. But now going into this year, Sanders went to the Saints in free agency, and now they have Deebo Samuel, who's hurt, and a bunch of kind of unknowns at receiver. So that was an issue going into last season. They put a Band-Aid on it, and now it's an issue again going forward. So I think they have some underlying issues in their secondary as well that kind of get covered up because the pass rush is so strong. But the receiving core, I think if you're kind of circling a weakness from last year that comes over to this year, I think it's that.
Fast forward to the offseason, talk about some of the impact loss, impact gains. You've mentioned Emmanuel Sanders headed to the Saints, where he gets to pair up with Michael Thomas for Drew Brees. So Emmanuel Sanders out. They trade DeForest Buckner. Who are the other impact losses? I said Matt Breida, no longer on the team. But who are the other losses that they sustained in the offseason? How will that affect them moving forward?
Well, you touched on kind of the three big ones. They lost Joe Staley, their longtime left tackle. He retired, but they traded for Trent Williams within like hours. The Trent Williams trade news actually came down before Staley retired. So the writing was on the wall once they traded for Williams. So they lost a key piece of their offensive line, but then they got a 7-time Pro Bowler and maybe even improved at that position, which is kind of hard to believe because Staley was so good for so long. But you touched on all the other ones. They traded DeForest Buckner in the fifth year of his rookie contract. They got the number 13 pick back for him, traded back one spot in the draft and drafted Javon Kinlaw. They lose Emmanuel Sanders, as you already mentioned. And then their right guard, Mike Person, they cut him as well. So they have an opening at right guard. But other than that, continuity was their goal going into this offseason. And I think they, for the most part, in a hard-capped NFL, I think they did a pretty good job of maintaining continuity.
Who are the guys, the biggest additions? You mentioned Trent Williams. Anyone else of note that they added to their team? I mean, in the draft, they also they got Javon Kinlaw, you got Brandon Ayuk, you got the draft class. Who do you expect to contribute this year among free agent additions and the draft picks?
So I think the two draft picks you mentioned, the two first round picks, Kinlaw and Ayuk, are going to be really big. Ayuk especially now, if Deebo Samuel winds up missing time, he has a chest fracture, it's a foot injury. It's really tough for a receiver to come back from quickly. It's a 12 to 16 week injury. Deebo says he'll be back in 10. I'm not sure I really buy that. And if the season's going to start on time on September 13th, when they host the Cardinals, that's right at the kind of beginning of that 12 to 16 week range. So they could be without Deebo Samuel early in the year. And I think that's going to, the responsibility to pick up that slack is going to fall a lot on Ayuk. So I expect him to contribute quite a bit. Kinlaw, the same thing. He's not going to be 100% of the snaps DeForest Buckner was playing, but he's going to play a lot of them. And I mentioned earlier that defensive line drives everything the team does. They had, I think, the second best starting field position in the league last year because of how good their defense was. And I think their offense really ticks because of that. So I think it's going to come down to those two draft picks. And then Trent Williams, he didn't play all last year. I'm assuming he's going to come back and be good. He's going to have fresh legs. It's not like he's coming off a major injury. He had the cancerous growth in his skull that he had removed, but he's clear from that now and appears to be ready to go. So he'll be, if he's back at 100%, the Niners offense, I think, is going to be better along the offensive line.
And the transition from the Washington offense to the 49ers offense shouldn't be much, because Shanahan was a Gruden guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he was a Shanahan guy, who's a Mike Shanahan guy. But really, Gary Kubiak is where, okay, where Shanahan's offense kind of comes in. But his first year as Washington's offensive coordinator was 2010, when they drafted Trent Williams, number 4 overall. So Trent Williams has 3 years in the Mike Shanahan scheme, which is very similar. So, yeah, like you said, I don't think the learning curve in the shortened offseason is gonna affect him too much.
Any other looming issues? There's one that's kind of popped up recently, and that's Raheem Mostert requesting a trade, wanting to be paid on par or more than the other backs on the roster, and Jerick McKinnon, Tevin Coleman. And I can understand the sentiment. Granted, he did sign a contract, a 3-year deal last year. How do you see that playing out? And will that be a problem moving forward?
Man, so it comes down a lot to like running back value and how teams value running backs nowadays. The fact of the matter is Raheem Mostert has 170 career carries. He had 107 last year, and he turned it into 722 yards. Like he rips off yards at a really impressive clip. And then everybody saw how good he was in the NFC title game, 220 yards and 4 touchdowns. And he was even good in the Super Bowl. He just didn't get a ton of touches. So the issue with Mostert is that he's 28. He has a really small sample size in the NFL. 170 carries is not a lot. Like that's not a ton for one season, much less.
No. Six. Well, and what is it? I think I saw two games where he's had more than 15 carries in a game, right?
Yeah. 19 against the Ravens in Baltimore. And then he had 29 in that game against the Packers where the Niners were just dominating. So yeah, like you said, he has never been a featured back. He got more work towards the end of last year. I think the final five games, he had 8 touchdowns over the final 6, I think. He was really good to end the year, but in Kyle Shanahan's offense, you kind of need to be able to do everything. And Raheem Mostert runs it, and that's it. He's not a good pass blocker. He had 180 receiving yards, 150 more after the catch. So there's a lot of screens, a lot of short throws. He's not a guy that you can split out wide and have him go out and run a route. And that's something that Tevin Coleman can do. Jerick McKinnon can do that. I think undrafted rookie Jamichael Hasty out of Baylor, I think that's something he'll be able to do. And Mostert, at least last year, could not do that. And so I think what the Niners are looking at is like, man, you're getting paid about half of what Jerick McKinnon makes, or not Jerick McKinnon, but Tevin Coleman, because you do about half of what he can do on a field. And I don't know. I think it was an interesting tactic by Brett Tesler, Raheem Mostert's agent, to just come out and publicly request a trade. Because think of this, like you, and I guess it's different because the Cardinals traded David Johnson and got DeAndre Hopkins back. But I don't think there is a team pining for a 28-year-old running back that can't catch and can't pass block, who has 170 carry sample size. The Niners are probably going to need at least a fifth back for him and maybe more. And a team would have to unload a mid-round pick and then pay him upwards of $5 million a year. And I just don't know how many teams are going to be clamoring to do that. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. I do think Raheem Mostert sticks around in a 49ers uniform, though.
Looking ahead to the coming season, coming off the Super Bowl loss, that doesn't always, like, if you kind of look at the last couple of years, and historically, the Super Bowl loser does not always do well the next year. There's kind of the hangover effect. Now, what are your thoughts? What are your expectations for the Niners moving forward? Could they have a hangover season of any sort? And lastly, how do you think they match up? Not necessarily predictions or anything, but how do you think they match up against the Cardinals? Because the Cardinals did play them tougher than other teams, but ultimately still lost both games. So.
Okay, I have takes on that second part. The first part of the question, though, with the Super Bowl hangover, I think in a typical offseason, I think I would have a little bit more concern about it from the 49ers standpoint. But they're going to be at such an advantage in this offseason, especially if there's no preseason, which it kind of looks like that's the direction we're heading. I know you were on the NFLPA call today. From what I saw of tweets of that call, it sounds like the Players Association is kind of pushing for like, hey, let's cancel the preseason and make sure we have a full training camp. And if that's going to be the case, I think the Niners and all their continuity are going to be at such a huge advantage. And so when it comes to that Super Bowl hangover, I think while some teams are trying to kind of get their legs under them, bring new players and are still kind of in a preseason mode when the season starts, I think the Niners will be able to hit the ground running. And when it comes to trying to get back to the playoffs and make a deep playoff run, if they can get an extra 2 or 3 wins in the first 4 weeks, that's a really big deal, especially in the NFC or the NFC West in particular, where I think the Cardinals are going to be really good. I think the Seahawks are going to be there as always. The Rams, I think,
They're Sean a wild card. They could be good.
Yeah.
They could be bad.
Sean McVay started using Gerald Everett and Tyler Higbee more last season, and their offense kind of took off. And so I think that's something they're going to integrate more because he's smart. So I'm not writing off the Rams. I think the NFC West is going to be really good. The Packers are still going to be all right. You're going to have the Vikings and the Saints. I just, there's a lot of really good teams in the NFC. So if the Niners, who they play the Cardinals, which I'll get to in a second, but then they get the Jets, Giants, Eagles, like if they can pick up some wins early on in the year, I think that they'll be in pretty good shape to avoid that Super Bowl hangover. As far as the Cardinals go, the Cardinals, I think, are going to be a huge problem for the Niners as long as Kyler Murray is under center. He was awesome last year against San Francisco. And I've watched the Niners play against Russell Wilson, and I don't like using like historical comparisons because Russell Wilson in 2013 has nothing to do with Kyler Murray in 2020, right? But that style of quarterback has just always given the Niners trouble. And it's not just that Kyler is fast or has a good arm. Like he's smart, and he just generates a lot of problems for a pass rush that is like get around the edge and get home. Well, if you get home and he's gone, it exposes a lot of the flaws in the Niners defense. And I think that Kyler did that last year. I mentioned the Niners secondary was not great in 2018. It was a lot better last year because the pass rush was making quarterbacks make throws that they didn't make. So Kyler, I think, is immune to that a little bit. And at least offensively, the Cardinals are going to be a problem for a long time for the Niners. And then Chandler Jones is really good. I think Isaiah Simmons is going to be a game changer on defense for them. So I imagine the Cardinals are going to be, if they're not like a playoff contender, which I have them penciled in to be, I think they're going to be a real issue for the Niners because they were last year, and I think they're going to be even better this year.
So what is your floor and ceiling kind of for the Niners this year in terms of wins?
I think their ceiling is again, probably like 13 wins. Their floor is assuming, barring a like major injury, I think their floor is probably like 9.
That's a lot going wrong too. I think they're a 10 to 14 win team personally.
Yeah.
Probably still the favorite for the division. Yeah. And I'm really excited this year because of the extra playoff spot and the fact that the Cardinals were able to play. I mean, the results don't look like this. You see a couple. You see them going 0-2 last year in games. But against in that first game on the Halloween game, the way the offense was playing, it felt like one stop and the Cardinals had a chance to win. But the Cardinals couldn't do that. And then they actually gave the defense a lead late in the fourth quarter and had it fall apart. Mm-hmm. That happened three games last year when the Cardinals gave the offensive gave the defense a lead in the final minutes of the fourth quarter or overtime in three games that they lost. It happened in week one. It happened against the San Francisco game in San Francisco, and it happened against Tampa Bay. So if in three games that defense makes one play, makes one stop, they're an 8-8 team last year.
Blah. Right. Yeah, that well, and the second game, I think the Niners ended up winning by 10, but it was because of the fumble recovery for a touchdown at the end. Like the score looks pretty lopsided, but the Cardinals, I completely agree with you. The Niners needed to get, I think it was 3 third down conversions on the Halloween game on their final drive, and they converted all 3 of them.
And then they
had the game there at Levi's where I think Kyler ran one in late and then they drove down. But that was I lived in Arizona for a while, so I have a bunch of friends who are Cardinals fans, and my buddy was texting me after the Cardinals had taken the lead, and he was like, this is where the defense falls apart. Like they've done this all year. And sure enough, I mean, so if their defense is even a little bit better this year, the Cardinals are going to be a problem.
If their defense is just not terrible,
if it's average.
Like last year, they were like the stat that I keep pulling out is that they for the season they gave up a quarterback rating of 109. That's better than Hall of Fame level for every team. So every quarterback was a Hall of Famer against them.
Oh man, that's brutal. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How do you think is adding DeAndre Hopkins going to fundamentally alter their offense at all? Or is it just like, all right, they got a little bit better at receiver?
I really think at least the pass game will, it's a game changer. Because, well, they know they can run the ball. Kingsbury's run schemes, they rival Kyle Shanahan in terms of effectiveness. And by adding Hopkins, a true number one, because last year teams treated Christian Kirk like a number one.
They
put their number one corner on him, and you put Hopkins, who's going to win against number ones. Now you're now you're moving Kirk to a number two or a number three, and you still got to get fits. I think it's a game changer for the passing game, and I think I expect this offense to be potentially a top five offense in terms of, because they have the passing schemes, they have the schematics, but they just didn't get the early. It was Kyler's decision making and the receivers not winning very much. And late in the year, they use the running game a lot, but I think things will open up in the passing game significantly this year. And having a Kenyon Drake from week one, as opposed to David Johnson, who really struggled. And I mean, I have mixed feelings about how the things went down with David Johnson, but it was very clear that he did not fit or understand the offense all that well. When he got the ball, carried the ball more than when he got the ball 14 plus times, he was effective. He was an effective back, although he wasn't the same back as from 2016. Not but now that's 4 years ago. But he looked uncertain. And Kenyon Drake doesn't have that issue. So he comes in, 3 days rest, and he's like, oh, there's a hole I'm going to run, and I'm going to run past people.
He's really good against the Niners on Halloween.
Yes, he was. That was exciting. So I anticipate the Niners will be the class of the division still, provided Garoppolo can play at the level, stay healthy, play roughly at the level that he played last year. He proved to me that while he's not an elite quarterback, he's a really good quarterback.
Yeah.
It helps that he's playing in an offense that does make quarterbacks look good. We saw Nick Mullins look great.
Nick Mullins also, I know everyone watched that game against the Raiders. Nick Mullins had some games where he looked really bad.
Yeah. But he did look better than CJ Beathard.
Boy, did he. Not a very high bar.
No. And because of that, the Cardinals picked up two extra wins in 2018. How they managed to sweep the Niners when they were their worst team ever.
One of my favorite photos to use. Well, the Niners did that too. The Niners and Cardinals always kind of do that. The Niners had a year they went 2-14 and beat the Cardinals twice in overtime both times. Like 2006 or 7 or something. But anyways, where was I going with that? It was one of my favorite photos to use when I do Niners Cardinals stuff is the one of Chandler Jones strip sacking CJ Beathard, because it's just so CJ Beathard, like holding on the ball for too long, no pocket awareness, and Chandler Jones is running just around just failing, knocking
strips
the ball
it away, and Buddha picks it up and runs with it. That was fun. Thanks for your time, Kyle. Really appreciate it. You can find Kyle's work at NinersWire.com. It's one of the USA Wire sites, NinersWire.USAToday.com. He's also one of the co-hosts of the Candlestick Chronicles podcast. And you can follow him on Twitter at Kyle A. Madsen. Kyle, really appreciate your time for taking a little bit of time to discuss the 49ers. Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We'll be back, and we'll move on to week two. The Washington football team. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. Welcome back to the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. And we move on to the next segment. And what we're going to talk about now is the Cardinals' week two opponent, the franchise formerly known as the Redskins in Washington. And to help us talk about that team, I have Zachary Neal from is still recording as it as of right now. The team name hasn't changed, from RedskinsWire.com, the USA Today NFL wire site covering Washington's franchise. And by the time this airs, there probably will be a new team name as the Redskins announced that they are retiring the name of that franchise. after decades of talk and controversy about that, but they will have a new name by the time you guys have heard this. So we'll refer to them as the Redskins for now, or the Washington, or however we're going to do that. But thank you, Zach, for coming on today to kind of preview the Redskins. How's everything going for you these days?
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm glad I could get on with you. Things are going well. Things are a bit chaotic, as you can tell. A lot of news coming out of Washington right now. We don't really know where things are going to be by the time week two comes around and we actually get together again to talk.
Right. Kind of the things we're going to talk about in this segment, for those who are listening, is we're going to have Zach kind of go back and kind of recap how 2019 was, which wasn't a good year for Washington. We're going to look at impact losses, impact gains, some of the big offseason stories, which we've already kind of kicked off talking about, and what are their expectations heading into 2020, as well as how they will match up against the Cardinals, as that will be the Cardinals' season, well, rather their home opener, playing in week two. So let's go ahead and get started. Aside from what's going on now, obviously you guys have a new head coach, Ron Rivera, but take me through the 2019 season. Obviously, Cardinals fans can sympathize with this based on what they went through in 2018, but what ultimately went wrong? But what were some of the bright spots? So what went wrong? What were the bright spots for the 2019 season?
I think what went wrong is just nobody was on the same page. I mean, it started out in the draft. I mean, I think the Redskins are kind of a year behind where the Cardinals were. I mean, with the Josh Rosen situation, you had a coaching staff that really didn't want Dwayne Haskins drafted in the first round, and they were very vocal about it. They said right from the get-go that they didn't want him, because you had Jay Gruden knew that he would be coaching for his job. And so he didn't want to have to groom a rookie quarterback and know that it would probably be another losing season. So they brought Case Keenum in, and he did all right, as well as you can expect Keenum to do. And then once Haskins got in there, he wasn't ready, as many rookie quarterbacks aren't. I mean, there's a select few. I mean, Kyler Murray did well last year, but he's one of the rare exceptions that you actually have a very productive rookie season. So all in all, 3-13 year, it really was a long dredge through some really crappy games. And it didn't seem like anyone really had that much fun. I don't think fans enjoyed it. I don't think a lot of players enjoyed it. But there, like you said, there are a few bright spots. I think everyone kind of hit the reset button this offseason. Got a new coach in there, got some new front office people. A lot of players feel confident they're going to make a leap going into this next year. And I think, I'm careful in saying this, I think there's brightness ahead, but we'll see.
So as we hit the offseason, what does Ron Rivera bring? How do you like the hire of Rivera and what he's going to bring to the franchise?
When it was announced, I've been a big fan of Rivera in the past. I think he did great work in Carolina. He just brings the real stability that was severely lacking in Washington. He's a real players coach. Players like him a lot. They like playing for him. Owners like him. He's very upfront about what he wants to do. He's got a great solid background, grew up in a military family. He stresses discipline a lot, which was not something that happened under Jay Gruden in the last regime. So I think he's really going to get the ball rolling early on, and expectations, I mean, we'll get into expectations later, but they're not working to be good right away. They're really trying to build a base, build off of something for the next few years, and they're looking 5, 6, 7 years in the future instead of trying to win 10 games right now.
Okay, so fast forward a little bit as we hit free agency. Who are the players that are, who are the players that have left? How will that impact Washington this year? And who have they added that will make a difference?
Start with leaving. The big names is Trent Williams, obviously. He was a major player for them. He went over to San Francisco, and it's tough to say the addition by subtraction with a player as good as Trent Williams, but the drama that he brought with the team, and I'm not blaming him at all. There was a ton of factors. He was not all the blame. Bruce Allen was a lot to blame too. But just having him and that drama out of the locker room, I think, will benefit the team a lot. They also lost Eric Flowers, who had a very solid year last year at left guard. He was a good player. They lost Jordan Reed, the tight end. Used to be very good, still with injuries a lot as of late, and he's still a free agent looking for a team. But as far as what they lost, I don't think it's a huge missed opportunity, because I think they're really getting back to basics. And as far as bringing people in, the main signing was Kendall Fuller from the Chiefs, coming off the Super Bowl win. He was actually drafted by Washington a few years back and then traded away as part of the Alex Smith trade. And they told him, there's stories that have come out that when they traded him, they told him, hey, once you're a free agent in 2020, we're bringing you back here. So get ready. You're coming back here. You're a Washington player. And they stayed true to their word. And he was happy to come back. Fans are very happy to have him back. And hopefully he can get back to the level of play that we saw before he went out.
They added at the top of the draft Chase Young. What does that do? What impact do you think that the draft class that's coming is going to have? Obviously, Chase Young is kind of like the 2020 version of Nick Bosa, and some might say he might be even better. As good as Bosa was, what's kind of the expectation for Young as a rookie this year?
That addition is they didn't really need him. They already had, I mean, if you were to look at their strengths before the draft and before the new draft class came in, their strength was already on the defensive line. They had four first-round picks between Jonathan Allen, Darren Payne, Ryan Kerrigan, Montez Sweat, too, from last year, and then they just added the easily best player in the 2020 draft to it. So I think they're really going to lean heavy on their defensive front. They're going to try and get after the quarterback, stop the ball. And then as far as other players, there weren't any major hitters in the other picks, but very high upside players, low risk, hopefully. So they're really just trying to build a young core of high upside players, offensive weapons for Dwayne Haskins, and hope that they can materialize some of them.
In terms of big offseason stories, obviously the trade sending Trent Williams to San Francisco was one. Two was the... I mean, there was the talk. How serious was the talk, or was it just outside chatter, just talking heads like me, don't really know anything, where there was the talk that maybe the Redskins would pull what the Cardinals did and give up on Haskins and go with a guy like Tua Tagovailoa or Justin Herbert. Did that actually ever gain any traction? Was that something that actually was talked about within the organization? Or obviously it was talked about. We don't, but how realistic was that going to be?
I think it was super realistic this past year. However, if Haskins does not play well this year, it could be very realistic. There is a scenario where Washington goes 3-13, 4-12 again. Haskins doesn't play well. They have maybe not the number one, but the number two pick, and they get Trevor Lawrence or someone like that. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that Haskins is for sure the QB of the future. He has to earn that still. And I think that's a good thing, too. I think he needs something to drive him and make sure that he's playing up to caliber of what the team expects of him. So I don't know how serious it ever got this past offseason, but I wouldn't knock it going forward.
Kyle Allen, a guy Rivera's familiar with. How much competition is it going to be open competition, quote unquote, or is it a case where Allen will only take over if Haskins is bad in the preseason and such?
I think it's an open competition. I think it definitely is an open competition. If I had to choose who was going to win it, I'd say Haskins is probably the better quarterback. We've seen a lot of stuff from him this offseason where he's lost a lot of weight. He's looking good. His arm's stronger. He seems to be in the playbook and the film room as much as he can. So I think it's Haskins' job to lose. But then there's also the factor that maybe we have a shortened training camp. Maybe we have no preseason games where Haskins, I mean, he is trying to learn a new offense with a new offensive coordinator again. And you say, if he doesn't have the time that he needs to learn all of that, who did learn it all last year? Kyle Allen with the Panthers. So, and Rivera said that if they don't have the time to groom Haskins in the new offense like they want to, they feel comfortable leaning on Allen for a game or two if they need to.
And he did fantastically in the first few games, especially when he came off when he started in place of Cam Newton. Cardinals fans will remember that because Kyle Allen, like most quarterbacks against the Cardinals last year, looked like Hall of Famers. If you look at the Cardinals statistics last year, their pass defense, I think they were the worst at opposing quarterback passer rating at like 109. And you look at and you think about the context, 109 for every quarterback. So basically, the Cardinals were allowing every quarterback to be Hall of Fame status. It's fantastic. So
I remember that from fantasy football and getting your matchups every week. Oh, see if they're playing the Cardinals. Put them in.
So the whole name change, is that something that's going to impact the football side of things, or is that simply something that will be on the social side, on the media side? But do you think that that name change will do anything with the players?
Chance to. I think they're trying to be very careful about it. Ron Rivera has already come out and said, hey, we want to get this done with before training camp because we don't want our players being asked about this every time they talk to the media after every practice. Because that does become a distraction. Anytime you're talking about something other than the football that's being played on the field, it's not what you want. So if you have to have players weighing in on social issues, on what name they like, what name they don't like, it's something other than what they should be doing, which is talking about football. So I hope that they're trying to move quickly in order to make it not a problem, but I could see it being an issue going forward, but hopefully under the strength and the strength of Rivera, it's not something to worry about.
Looking ahead to this season, so what are realistic expectations for the Washington franchise? How many wins do you think is attainable? What's their best case, worst case? And more specifically, for my fans here, how do you think they match up against the Cardinals in week two?
Well, like I said earlier, expectations are not super high going into this year. I think they're being they've got mild expectations. I think a 6-10 season would be fantastic. I don't see them getting 7 wins. I think their main goal right now is not to finish in 4th place in the NFC East. All you're trying to do right now is beat the Giants, have a little bit of a good feeling going into the next season. And I don't think they're vying for a playoff spot this year, but I think that's very attainable next year. And as for your last question, the week two matchup against the Cardinals, it's going to be really interesting because I don't know what others think, but I am very high on what the Cardinals have done this offseason. I mean, you look at just some of the pre-agency moves they made and trades, getting David Johnson out, getting DeAndre Hopkins in. That alone just gets so much credit in my book. And then you look at their draft. They got Isaiah Simmons, who to me was the second best defender in the draft. I mean, I wrote articles back way before the draft that, oh, maybe Washington should trade down and get Isaiah Simmons instead of Chase Young because it's actually a position of need for them. But you look across their depth chart, they've got real weapons on offense. Obviously, Kyler, great player, Christian Kirk, Kenyon Drake. I mean, if they're all playing like they should, I think Arizona could be an actual surprise team this year. And I don't have much faith in that week two matchup for Washington fans. So we'll see what happens. I'll probably get some hate from fans here, but I'm just being honest with you.
Well, let's be honest. It's good to hear that because mostly the people who are going to be hearing this are Cardinals fans, not the Washington fans. So yeah. Thank you for pumping up the Cardinals in that sense. I think Washington, especially with how they're built on the front seven, will be able to cause some problems. The Cardinals did, obviously, the sack numbers were insane, so we know about that. But they could cause Kyler Murray some problems, especially with early in the season not being particularly in sync, depending on how things with the offense is. But a shout out to you, Zach, for coming on. That's Zach Neal, managing editor from the website WashingtonFootballWire.com. WashingtonFootballWire.com, formerly RedskinsWire.com. Zach, is there anything that our fans, that my listeners, should know about how to contact you to find your stuff on social media and or the site?
Follow me on Twitter at Zachary C. Neal. I'm very open. I like to engage with fans. So if you want to hit me up on there. I'll talk to you there, and we can have a chat about how that week two matchup's going to go.
Sounds good. Thanks for coming on, Zach. We'll talk to you later on in the season, I'm sure. Coming up next on the Rise FC Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We're going to move on to week three. The Cardinals' opponent in week three at home are the Detroit Lions. That's coming up next on Rise FC Red. We're back on the Rise FC Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. And we move on to talk about the Detroit Lions, the Cardinals, one of the Cardinals' first matchups of the seasons. They will face them in week three. To find out more about the Lions, a team that the Cardinals seem to always play year after year, I have welcomed and I've invited Jeff Risden, who runs LionsWire.com, the USA Today NFL wire site covering the Lions. He has a lot of hats over the years, a guy that's actually been doing this much longer than I have, and I've been doing it a long time. Jeff, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking some time. How are you doing?
Oh, my pleasure to be with you. Yeah, it's been a very long time wearing a lot of hats. That's what we do in this industry. And you're right. The Lions and Cardinals, they do seem to play like every year. Let's hope that this year there's a winner and a loser. Last year was kind of unsatisfying.
Well, I will say, as unsatisfying an end, it was a good ending considering how things started in the first half, because that was Cliff Kingsbury told us weeks later he thought he was going to get fired after the start. We've been talking about this offense, this newfangled offense that he was going to bring, and it was the performance of the first half was worse than they were doing against in all of 2018 when they had the worst offense in the league. He said, oh my gosh, he thought he was going to get fired. But then Kyler Murray did his thing. It was really, really fun to see.
It really was. It was an interesting matchup. It was definitely a tale of, like, really, really three quarters and then the final two quarters. The first three quarters, the Lions looked great and Arizona was kind of struggling. And then there was a couple of special team snafus, and that really turned the tide around.
And really, had Tremaine Brock not dropped that interception.
Oh, my goodness. That was a pick six. That was a game winner right there. So in many ways, a lot of Lions fans were pretty happy to end in the tie, even though they thought they probably should have had the win.
So, well, the Lions, not necessarily what you can expect, struggled last season after the injury to Matthew Stafford, who was surprisingly athletic. Like, not to say that he's surprisingly athletic, was surprisingly effective as a runner against the Cardinals. But let's take it back to the 2019 season. Obviously, things did not go well, as they ended up with a worse record than the Cardinals did overall. Take us back through the season a little bit. What happened? What went well? What didn't go well? And how did that compare to expectations to what was going into the season?
Yeah, they wound up 3-12-1. They were 3-4-1 with Matthew Stafford at the helm. He left after week nine with the bye in there. After that, they did not win a game. It was a very frustrating year because they held the lead in the fourth quarter of each of their first 13 games and won three of them.
Oh my God.
Really hard to do. It was Stafford was fantastic. He was having arguably his best season. Statistically speaking, he was almost dead on pace to exactly match Dan Marino's legendary year. That's how good he was last year. He had Kenny Golladay led the NFL in touchdowns, receptions with 11. Marvin Jones had 8. They both were very good. Jones got hurt again at the end of the year. Danny Amendola had the second best year of his career. The passing offense was definitely the highlight. Running game was... Well, you have to stage this. Understand that the Lions have not had a 1,000-yard. They've had one 1,000-yard rusher since Barry Sanders retired. That was 20 years ago. It's been a very long time. It's been a struggle. They actually ran the ball more successfully last year than normal, but are still well behind the rest of the league. They hope they fix that. But there's a number of combinations for that. The offensive line was good but not great at a lot of things, and that's sort of the status quo. Defensively, though, early on, and we talked about the Cardinals game at the beginning, they did a lot of things that were very innovative, and the biggest problem that they had was they did really well against Kansas City. It was week three. It was a third or fourth game, and they wound up rushing three and dropping eight in the coverage, and it really genuinely bothered Patrick Mahomes. He did not throw a touchdown pass in the game. The problem was that the Lions bought too hard into that and quit rushing the passer, and other teams figured it out. They're rushing three. They're not going to be able to cover forever, so let's just hold the ball for longer. Dak Prescott, when they played in week 10 or week 11, he actually said he was able to go through his progressions twice in the pocket. It just wasn't there. So the pass defense was abysmal. There was no pass rush at all. They have some good players, but, Trey Flowers is a really, really good defensive end. Romeo Okorah on the other side is decent. They have some good players in secondary, but you can't cover forever, and they figured they got burned by that too much, so we're hoping that changes going forward. It was a very tough season. A lot of injuries, not just Stafford, but Marvin Jones got hurt. A couple of offensive linemen were in and out of the lineup at various times. The defensive line, the starting projected four up front played exactly 12 snaps together all season. Now, they run a 3-4, 4-3 hybrid, so it kind of mixes around. But Deshaun Hand, Trey Flowers, A'shaun Robinson, who's no longer there, and who's the fourth one? Mike Daniels were the projected starting four. They played 12 snaps together.
It was
a very difficult year injury-wise. Guys in and out of the secondary times. Darius Slay missed a couple games. Tracy Walker is a really, really good young safety. Missed 2.5 games. It was just a very frustrating season to be a Lions fan.
So what is kind of the... what is the impression of Matthew Patricia so far? How hot is his seat, if it's hot at all? And what is kind of the belief in him moving forward?
Okay, so he has helped himself, not in the win column. He's got 9 wins in 2 seasons. He was a much better coach by the end of year 2 than he was at the beginning of year 1. He came in, he is a Bill Belichick disciple, and he thought that he needed to be the guy who does the Bill Belichick things, be adversarial towards the media, be condescending and hard on players. It was very Bill Parcells-ish, much more than just Bill Belichick, and it didn't work. He has changed. I saw it firsthand at the Senior Bowl where the Lions coached one of the rosters there. He's a different guy now. I'm not sure how much credit that's going to get him with a new owner. Our owner was 94-year-old Martha Ford. She stepped aside. Her daughter is taking over. There was a mandate from Martha that, playoffs need to happen or else. We don't know how that's going to play yet. And with the pandemic that we're in, that there's some certain variables there. They've got to be a lot better. His seat is definitely hot, and his seat is tied directly to the general manager, Bob Quinn, who hired him, who didn't really look anywhere else but hiring his old friend from New England. So he's on the right path. I just don't know if the path is going to be long enough if they don't win, at least 8 games. If Matthew Stafford gets a back injury, and obviously that's an extenuating circumstance that scuttles the team, and you just can't overcome that, especially not when Chase Daniels your backup. But if everything is healthy and the team is still not a legitimate playoff contender, he might not last past Thanksgiving.
That'd be an interesting thing to see. Now let's move forward to the offseason. Who are the impact losses? How will that affect them? Who are the impact additions, both in free agency and in the draft?
Biggest loss is Darius Slay, who's one of the best cornerbacks in the game. He did not have a good year last year. I gotta put that out there right away. He was not good last year, but he is, in general, still a very, very good and talented cornerback. And I think he's going to do very well in Philly as an aside. And I'm so rooting for him. I like the guy. Most of the defensive line is gone. Daniels is gone. Harrison's gone. A'shaun Robinson is gone. They have reinforced. They brought in Danny Shelton, who is going to be a smart pickup. He knows the system for being in New England and also in Cleveland, where they ran a version of it under Mike Pettine. They brought in Jamie Collins. He's probably the biggest name on defense that became free agency. He is sort of what everybody wants Isaiah Simmons to be. He's been that way for a long time. I don't think people realize how much of an athletic freak Jamie Collins is. He is an unbelievable athlete. He hasn't always played like it in the NFL, but he's got the chance to do a lot of really good things as sort of the They're going to use him as a pass rusher, but more as a cover line. He's the best coverage linebacker over the last 3 years than in the NFL, according to PFF. And having watched him in Cleveland as I cover the Browns and seeing him, I believe it. He's really, really good at it. So he's going to help quite a bit. If it gets Jerry Davis off the field more, that's a good thing. Davis, first-round pick, that just hasn't worked out. Sort of like Hassan Reddick, a guy that everybody
– That linebacker class in general, from 2017 was not – it was very underwhelming considering the talent they all had.
Yeah, exactly. And there's still hope there, as there is for Reddick, but it's probably not going to happen in Detroit. It's just like it's not going to happen in Arizona. Maybe they could trade for one of that. That'd be an interesting one. Offensively, the big move, they dumped right tackle Rick Wagner. They dumped right guard Graham Glasgow. In comes Hal Vitae at right tackle and the guard. So Detroit ran a guard rotation last year. They rotated guards around. They played four different ones. They're going to do that again this year. Third-round pick Jonah Jackson and fourth-round pick Logan Stenberg figure into that mix somewhere, but it's probably going to be Kenny Wiggins getting the primary run at right guard with I think Jackson's going to wind up taking the left guard, but we don't really know yet, and they rotate him around, so it's a really weird situation. That's the big change. They did add DeAndre Swift in the draft in hopes of jumpstarting the run game. Second round pick, he's going to be in there with Kerryon Johnson, who is probably getting hurt as we speak. That's just what happens with him. He's a really talented guy, but man, he cannot stay healthy. He has been injured 7 years in a row, going back to his senior year of high school. He's not had an offseason where he wasn't hurt.
Wow.
So it's tough to trust him. That explains why they went out and took Swift with the 35th pick. Swift's a really, really talented player. I'm not sure that he's the best fit for what they want to do, but I understand the rationale for it. And defensively, first-round pick Jeff Okuda, number 3 overall. He is expected to come in and be better than Darius Slay was last year. Based on what I've seen, I don't have a problem with that. I think he's going to be really, really good right away. I'll put on my Browns wire hat for a second. They drafted his running mate Denzel Ward, number 4 overall, in 2018. He made the Pro Bowl as a rookie, and Jeff Okuda is better at every single thing that you ask of a cornerback than Denzel Ward was at Ohio State. So the ceiling is very, very high for him. He's going to be counted on to do a lot right away. Desmond Trufant comes over as the number 2 cornerback. It's going to be interesting to see how that works. He's a steady guy. I'm not sure that he's worthy of being a number 2 anymore, but he's going to be better than Rashawn Melvin, who's gone, who started, I think, 11 games last year. And that just didn't go well. There was just a lot of madness going on with that. So that's the big thing. Oh, and we did change punters, and we don't know who the new punter is going to be yet. Sam Martin was a really, really good, was a decent punter. He was an amazing kickoff guy. And replacing that, he could spot the ball wherever he wanted. And the Lions actually wound up having really good average starting field position because Martin was the master of the high splash kick that landed at the 1 yard line. They got to find somebody to do that. We have an Aussie, rookie Aussie from Auburn, Aaron Sipos, and a practice squad holdover fighting for the punter and kickoff job. Matt Prater's a brilliant kicker. He does not kick off well. He doesn't like doing it. So it's a little bit more of an addition than you might think in Detroit, too.
Yeah, that complicates the punting situation a little bit when you've got an older kicker like that. Let's fast forward now. Aside from the moves, are there any other off-season stories surrounding the Lions? This everything they're doing in the off-season that's kind of hanging over the team, other than the personnel additions and subtractions.
Yeah, they did change defensive coordinators. Paul Pasqualoni is out. In comes Corey Unlin, who is from a different cloth. He is not a Belichick disciple. He is a Jim Johnson disciple. He worked with Jim Schwartz in Philadelphia the last couple of years. So we're all wondering, and I think Matt Patricia is wondering, how the influence of a guy who runs a very different base scheme is going to work. How much are they going to use that scheme versus what holds over from Patricia? And how does the personnel fit in it? They have a lot. I think they have 12 linebackers on the roster right now. 9 of them have a legitimate chance of making the team. So how all that sorts out is sort of weird. And it kind of depends on how the coordinator fits with it. The ownership change is as stable as you can get it, but there is still going to be some change with it. And I think that's something that is still out there that nobody really knows what's going on with, not being able to meet the players. That kind of thing is that's a tough variable. Beyond that, Matthew Stafford's back is the big thing. He looks great. I've interviewed people who have caught balls from him this offseason. Just his teammates have incredible faith in him. This is a guy, he's 32 years old. He's broken bones in his back 2 years in a row. You better believe there's some concern about that. But at the same time, the offense is basically built around him being awesome, and he was last year. That's the variable that nobody really wants to talk about. What if it happens again? We really don't want to jump off that bridge just yet.
What's the belief of in Stafford beyond this year? Are they looking for it? Are the Lions now in the phase where the Cardinals were with Carson Palmer, even though that Stafford is much younger than he was, where they're already thinking ahead to the future, or do they see him playing a few more years? I mean, assuming he stays healthy in 2020.
They would like him to still be there through at least 2022. They can get out of his contract after the season if they really want to, but it's a lot easier a year after that. And at that point, he will be 34, 35 at that point, because he hopefully has won a playoff game by then, but if not, that will be 15 seasons without a playoff win. Oof. I think at that point, everybody's probably going to be ready to move on. And there's a war in Lions fandom of he's been great, and he has won over even the most hardened critics in terms of how he plays on the field. But the team success has not been there. You know, and I know that's not a reflection on the quarterback, but at the same time, fans are going to hold it. If you're not winning it, it doesn't matter.
He reminds me a lot of Carson Palmer, except for his relationship with his first team. That's the only difference there.
Yeah.
But in terms of the type of player they are and the performance on the field, I see a lot of that. When Palmer retired, I secretly wanted the Cardinals to somehow manage to bring Matthew Stafford over.
It's a very good analogy, and it's one that I don't think a lot of people here appreciate all that well, in part because Detroit fans tend to not look outside of Detroit as much as a lot of other fan bases do. So I don't think they have an appreciation for both how good and how frustrating Carson Palmer was over the course of his career, both in Cincinnati, yes. Arizona, and in Oakland.
Fantastic. So looking ahead to this season, what is the you said there's kind of a mandate from ownership, or was. What are your expectations for this team moving forward? Best case, worst case scenario, and how do you think they match up against the Cardinals early in the year?
So the best case scenario is that Stafford is healthy, that the defense figures it out and plays to the sum of its talent, because there is a lot of talent on that side of the ball, specifically in the secondary. It's a really, really good secondary, especially if Okuda is as good as advertised. It's going to be one of the top five secondaries in the league. They do have talent up front. It just hasn't shown primarily because of scheme. If that all clicks, if the special teams remain good, if Stafford and Galladay and Marvin Jones and Danny Amendola are out there, this could be a team that wins 8 or 9 games. I think that's probably the ceiling just based on their talent. They don't have any true stars other than Stafford, and I think that's going to be it's tough to win without that at the NFL these days. Worst case scenario is that the defense last year was not an aberration, that Patricia's system just isn't working and Stafford gets hurt, and they could very well have the number one overall pick if that happens. And that's a very steep bottom, and I don't expect that to happen, but it's tough to have faith that they're not going to be – they are not as good on paper as in their own division as the Packers or the Vikings. They probably aren't as the Bears either, though. I think they have the chance to outplay them simply because of the quarterback position between the two teams there. It's going to be tough if they're not if Stafford isn't great and if that defense isn't better. They're not going to be a good football team, and Arizona should expect to win when they play in Week 3. Now, having said that, they did really well for the most part last year against mobile quarterbacks. They did a good job against Mahomes. They did a good job against Trubisky, except when penalties got in the way. So I don't want to at all lump Mitchell Trubisky in with Kyler Murray or these other people, but he is a mobile quarterback. That's what he is. He's certainly not good at it. Good at throwing the ball anyways. I wonder I am enamored by DeAndre Hopkins, and that addition is going to be an interesting one. And how they handle teams that have a true number one wide receiver, and that's not disrespect to Larry Fitzgerald, he's amazing.
But he's not a number one anymore.
No, he's not. Thank you for saying that. I wanted to make sure that I was friendly in saying that. So I'm looking forward to how he tests with Okuda and whether Okuda falls more on the field or not. So the defensive line for Detroit has an advantage over the offensive line of Arizona, as I think most teams probably will. And that is something that can impact it. Now, if they are able to use a guy like Jared Davis or Jelani Tavai or Christian Jones as a spy on Kyler or a safety, a guy like Daron Harmon who's coming in or Tracy Walker, they have the ability to limit things that way. And I'm pretty confident that they'll be able to do that. But they can't stop both a good run attack and a good number one wide receiver. They just don't have the personnel for it. So will the Lions offense be able to outscore them? You know what? The Cardinals defense to me is a bit of an enigma. There's talent there, but I got to see it all play together first before I'm a believer in it. That's just where I'm at with it. The Lions offense had a lot of success at it last year. They ran the ball really well. The defense had no answer for TJ Hockenson, who is back, hopefully healthy by that point. He was amazing.
He was going to be a Hall of Famer after one week.
Yeah. 10 catches, 133 yards, I think it was. He wound up not doing much for the rest. I don't want to say he was a disappointment. It was underwhelming the rest of the year.
Well, especially with when you open with that game.
Right, yeah, and that sort of set the bar unrealistically high. But he is indeed a problem still, even with the additions that Arizona has made. There's only so many places that those guys can be, and the Lions do have impressive weaponry. If they get a pass rush, though, it's going to be a problem. So it's insanely early to predict it, but I don't expect the Lions to win against Arizona. I think Arizona is an up-and-coming team. I think that I really like the additions. I am a huge DeAndre Hopkins fan, so that probably colors my vision a little bit. My son is a Texans fan. He has a DeAndre Hopkins jersey in his closet. Which he still weeps over occasionally. Oh. Just that addition and the ability to get out from under David Johnson's contract. That's amazing to me.
It was fantastic.
So I am a fan of what Arizona did this offseason. I think that they did enough that it's certainly not going to end in a tie again. Hopefully somebody will go for two or something like that along the way. But it's one that the Cardinals should not overlook at Detroit, but they should also go into it with a certain expectation that this is probably one of the easier games on our schedule, being honest with you.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate the time. That's Jeff Risden. He's actually super easy to find on Twitter because his at is Jeff Risden.
Easy enough.
You can talk to him about Browns. You can talk about the Lions as he manages both of those sites for our network. And, of course, for other great coverage for the Lions, you go to lionswire.com, part of the NFL Wire site of the USA Today family of sites. Thank you, Jeff, for your time. And coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web, we move on to Week 4. In the last segment of this edition of the show, the Cardinals will take on the Carolina Panthers. That's who we've got previewed next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. And next up in our season previews is with the Carolina Panthers. And to help us out with that, I've invited Panthers Wire managing editor Tim Weaver to join us. And Tim has been gracious enough to give us a little bit of time to talk about the Panthers. How are things going for you, Tim?
Pretty well. Still in a little bit of a lockdown here, but got to do what you got to do right now.
Absolutely. It's good that you're staying safe and everything else. So let's go back to the 2019 season. We'll kind of start off with a kind of a recap of what was expected in 2019, what went well, what didn't go well, and then kind of move towards the offseason, impact additions, impact losses. You have the coaching change, of course, and then outlook for the upcoming season. So looking back at the 5-11 campaign last year, it was marred by the injury to Cam Newton that pretty much caused them to lose pretty much the whole season. You had Kyle Allen, who looked great out the gate. The Cardinals made him look like a Hall of Famer like they did pretty much every quarterback last year. But tell us about that 5-11 season. What went right? What went wrong? What were the expectations going into last year?
Yeah, not a lot went right. You have to really appreciate Bill Belichick playing 7D chess. He injured Cam Newton in the preseason so that he can pick him up for about $1 million this year. He was really playing many levels ahead of everyone else. But, it was an unfortunate injury, and they misdiagnosed it. They called it a foot sprain, when it turned out to be a wrist sprain. And then they put him out there weeks 1 and 2 when it was clear he wasn't really Cam Newton. He could still make some of those great throws, but you could tell like something just wasn't right, and he wasn't running at all. I think Ron Rivera made a mistake to play him in those games, and this wasn't the first time. In 2016, when he first hurt his shoulder, they had no realistic chance of making the playoffs late in the year, but they put him out there anyway. Then 2018, he hurt his shoulder again, and by the end of it, he could barely throw 20 yards. They should have shut him down much earlier than they did. So basically, third time was the charm, and it cost Rivera his job, among other things. Kevon Short also getting into weeks really hurt. So you take away any team's franchise quarterback and their best defensive lineman, they're going to have a tough time. I don't know what any coach could have done under those circumstances, but Rivera just didn't really manage that stuff as well as he could have. Biggest thing schematically they did wrong, I think, was they tried this 3-4 defense a little too long. They just stuck with it. Now, it helped the pass rush. They finished second in sacks behind the Steelers, but they just got run over by everybody. After about week 5, week 6, teams figured out, oh, we can just run over you and you're not going to be able to stop it. So in the end, they wound up allowing more yards to carry than any team, and I think 8 more rushing touchdowns than any other team. So it was just a total disaster for run defense. That's one of the big things they're going to have to work on in 2020.
So that takes us to the offseason where they make the coaching change. Obviously, they made the coaching change before the end of the year. Matt Rhule is the new guy. What is the feel so far with him as he now becomes another non-NFL, like head coach who hasn't head coached in the NFL? The Cardinals did it with Cliff Kingsbury. What's sort of the expectation? What's the feel with Matt Rhule coming in now?
Obviously, it's a little early to say, but they got the right guy for the situation that they're in. I don't know. It's a huge investment. They're going to be paying him more per year than Andy Reid is making right now. So it gives you some idea of the gamble that they're taking here. But it took him 2 years to turn around the program at Temple and the same thing at Baylor. So if he can do the same thing here, he's pretty much the same situation. He's coming in at the bottom. You got a 5-11 team. They're definitely the worst team on paper in that division, as a just a really brutal division. If he can do it in 2 years, if he can get them back to like 9-10 wins over 500, then he's going to have a good career. I think 6 wins this year would be great, considering the number of holes that they have. So the gauntlet is laid down, and like the situation hasn't made anything easier. He said he's only met like 20 of his players. they've all been virtual meetings, so he doesn't even know these guys. They've had no offseason. I mean, who knows if we were going to have a preseason. So he's going to have to earn that money.
Sounds like it. So we move forward to the offseason in the free agent in the draft. Who are the impact losses? We know Cam Newton, number one. Who are the impact losses? How will they affect them? Who are the impact additions in free agency in the draft, and how they are anticipated to contribute this season?
Well, the losses was basically the entire defense, starting with Luke Kuechly. There's just no replacing him. He had the best off-ball linebacker in the league. He had a few head injuries, so that was maybe something you could see coming, and they gave Shaq Thompson a long extension in December. But it came as a surprise to pretty much everybody who's covering the team that he just, wow. I had a very strong reaction in our Slack channel. There's a huge shock, and there's just no way you can replace a guy like that. Would have helped if they had drafted Isaiah Simmons, but that's another story. they wound up getting Tahir Whitehead, so I mean, he does some things well, but you're basically going from the best coverage linebacker in the league to arguably the worst. He's given up more touchdowns than any other linebacker over the last 2 seasons, so that's a really tough loss. James Bradbury left. He was their best cornerback. Not a superstar, but they didn't really find a great replacement until late in the year with Eli Apple. He had struggles. They're going to probably start him and Dante Jackson outside. They both had issues in coverage last year. Jackson actually got benched the last couple games of the season, so that's not ideal. Quarterback is really the big thing, especially being in the NFC South with these. I don't think there's a division that has better wide receivers, and they're all really big. Mike Evans is giving them trouble. Julio Jones, 300 yards on him one time. Team of big receivers is just going to dominate them because they just don't have a lot of length. Troy Pride was their big their draft pick at corner in the fourth round, and he's more of a slot size kind of guy. I don't think they're going to play him in the slot, but they just don't have a lot of length and size out there, and they're going to get beat up one-on-one. So basically the entire defense, the pass rushers are all gone. Mario Addison, Bruce Irvin. Last year they're paying their defensive tackles way more than any other team in the league, but they're all gone now. Gerald McCoy is gone. Vernon Butler's gone. Don Terry Poe's gone. Taking Derek Brown in the top 10, that's going to help. I think he's going to be a good player, but you just there's no way to make up for this many losses in one offseason. It's going to take some time.
Then who are the players that were at it? You mentioned a couple. Anything on offense of note?
The big thing on offense is the offensive line changes. They traded Trey Turner to the Chargers for Russell Okung. Not a fan of the trade. I kind of understand why they did it. They haven't had a good left tackle since Jordan Gross retired like 7 years ago. But Okung, he had a health, not even just an injury, he had a pulmonary embolism last year, so that's a big question mark. They also, teams over the guards, they lost Greg Van Rotten. You're going to have Michael Schofield, who's with the Chargers. It's pretty much the Chargers' offensive line is what they have now. They brought in Pat Meyer, who was their coach there the last 3 years. Pretty much everyone was a Charger at one point, except Paradis at center. And Taylor Moten, he's really the only sure thing they have. He's the best lineman by far. He's the only thing you can really rely on. And Robbie Anderson, I really like that pickup. They hadn't spent money on a wide receiver for a long time. Cam Newton will run. It was more than just a little ironic. The same day they released Cam Newton, they finally signed a wide receiver. They paid for Robbie Anderson. So a little bizarre there, but I think he fits really well. If they can get Teddy Bridgewater, who's obviously the big change, you know, he's not Cam Newton. He's not the same athlete that he is. He doesn't have the same abilities. It's a very different kind of dynamic. But I think he's a great fit for this offense. I'd actually said the last couple of offseasons before this one, they should sign Bridgewater. Then the idea was for him to be Cam's backup. I wasn't expecting him to be the starter. So, you know, you have to temper your expectations some. But I do like the fit, especially, you know, he has experience with Joe Brady. They're going to do some things I think we probably haven't seen before. As Cardinals fans probably experienced some last year, having a new offensive coordinator, you know, something, there's no tape out there really to see what they're going to do. I think it gives you a little bit of advantage. So I'm excited to see that. The offensive line is even just average. It's going to be a good offense. It's going to be fun to watch.
And obviously they got Christian McCaffrey who, you know, quietly, when I looked at the stats earlier in the offseason, I had not realized that he'd done it. After having David Johnson talk about, I think, the 1,000 club, and then to see, oh, wait, McCaffrey did it. Fantastic on the ground, great pass catcher, and they paid him a lot of money. What are your thoughts on the extension? Because the big running back contracts haven't really paid off for teams in recent history.
Yeah, you know firsthand with David Johnson. I can't believe they got DeAndre Hopkins for that. That's just yeah, you get a bad running back contract and you get a late wide receiver in exchange. Must be nice. I mean, he deserves it. You know, I'm always on the side of the players should get paid. I want everyone to get paid. But you know what the analytics say, if you give running backs big money, it's not going to work out. Like, they're going to regret it eventually. But he deserves to be the highest paid back in the league, like, no question about that. And he's only 23 years old. Like, yes, he had over 400 touches last year of a lot of work. But he's only 23 years old, and he's just a magnificent athlete. This guy, you know, some people are special, you know, like Jerome Bettis. He was effective until he was in his mid-30s. Some guys are just built a little different. Marshawn Lynch, same way in a different kind of dynamic. You know, some guys are special. Some, you know, the traditional wisdom about running backs doesn't apply to them. And I think McCaffrey's one of those.
What's your take on Derek Brown? You say he's going to be a good player. Was he worth the pick at number 7? Personally, when the draft came around, I was hoping that Brown would be gone, because I think Isaiah Simmons is going to be a much more dynamic player and a much better fit in the top 10 for the type of player that Brown is. A very, very good player, but probably not the dynamic impact player in the passing game that you want from a defensive tackle in the top 10. How do you see him fitting in that Panthers defense?
I agree. I think he's going to be probably a Pro Bowler. Like, every top 10 pick they've had in the last 20 years has gone on to be an All-Pro. So odds are he's going to be good. But for a top 10 pick, I just don't think you can take a run stuff. He's mostly a run-stuffing defensive tackle. You don't know. He could develop into be a good pass rusher. If he winds up being Fletcher Cox, then fine. It's all for it. It was a good pick. But the odds are against that. I just think it would have made a lot more sense to take Simmons, given the number of holes on defense that they have. You need a guy who can play four or five different positions well. That's just going to be more valuable than any defensive lineman. Even if, I think they're going to play inside and outside some, but there's just no comparison as far as positional value. I was shocked. I had a whole post ready to go. And I said, "Oh, Simmons, this is going to be the pick. It's ready." Then, of course, not. So that's how my draft night went.
Agree. I think I had five different player picks written up because of how, you know, being in the eighth pick, you never know. Looking ahead to 2020, then, what are you touched on it early on, like six wins would be good, but what is the, there is some feeling around the league, not to the extent of the Jaguars, but the Panthers are going to be bad, that they might be kind of tanking. That I don't necessarily believe that completely with the addition of Teddy Bridgewater. He's a guy who's proven he can win games. He did it when he was with Minnesota. He was very effective with the Saints last year. But does it look like to you that they're trying to improve over last year, or do you think they might take a step back?
Yeah, if they were tanking, they wouldn't have signed Bridgewater. I didn't understand. I like Teddy a lot. I like his game. I like the fit. But as far as team building goes, it didn't make that much sense to me. I think you're going to pay Teddy Bridgewater $21, $22 million over the next couple of years. Why not pay Cam Newton that $21 million that he was owed in 2020? Maybe he can never get back to the way he was. Maybe the injuries have just become too much. But the fact that Belichick was willing to take a chance on him says everything you need to know. People have been saying the last three or four months, Cam's washed up. Cam can't do anything. Oh, somebody disagrees who knows more than you.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, just like the whole thing was kind of a mishmash. I wish that they had taken more of a clear picture. That's kind of the theme this offseason, is that there is no clear vision of what they wanted to do. Signing McCaffrey was part of that. They could have picked up his fifth-year option. You know, they didn't have to pay him when they did. Maybe they saved some money down the road. But as far as like building the next couple of years, it didn't make much sense. They were tanking, or if they're going to try to contend this year. So it's hard to say what they're doing. I think that's Marty Herney. I think he's a great guy. Obviously better than me, that I would do as a GM. But it's confusing trying to follow what he was doing. I think eventually Matt Rhule, given the length of his contract and the investment that they've made in him, he's going to be taking over more of this stuff. But maybe there's already a little bit of conflict there. There's one report that said he wanted to trade down in the first round, and Herney said, no, Brown is our guy. We're going to take Brown. So I thought that was very interesting. But that, to me, says Rhule kind of has his head on more. I think trading down would have been the right move. I would trade down twice, you know, given the number of holes that they had. That would have been the right thing to do.
Looking ahead, what is your win prediction or your win window, floor, ceiling? And then how do you see them matching up with the Cardinals as they will face them again? The Panthers have, you know, especially in the playoffs, it seems that the Jake DeLone game might have kind of cursed the Cardinals, aside from the 2013 lots of sacks of Cam Newton game. But as you look ahead to the season in week four, that'll be, how do you see the Panthers and Cardinals matching up, and what is your prediction for how many wins that Carolina wins this year?
Yeah, Vegas says 5.5 is the over-under. I'm going over just a little bit. I'd say 6-10. Absolute best-case scenario, nobody gets injured. They get lucky with turnovers and penalties and everything else. They can go 8-8, but that's the absolute best. That's not going to happen. So I think between 4-12 and 7-9 is probably their range. Cardinals matchup, I would have liked better last year, even with Kyle Allen. you know, it wasn't hard to see the way that was going. Like, yes, his stats were good, but it was clear that, you know, he wasn't the guy. Some people got very excited after he was 4-1 and said, oh, forget about Cam Newton. He's the guy. I'm like, no, not the way that would ever work out. But I just think the Cardinals addressed what they needed to really well. I watched the game against the Saints a few days ago on Game Pass, and I found myself saying, oh, if they had a linebacker, they would have made that stop there. Or if they had a wide receiver, that's a catcher, that's a touchdown. And, like, they filled those two holes really well, obviously, with Simmons and Hopkins. He's just going to eat. They don't have anybody who's going to match up with him one-on-one. Unless they're going to bracket him, he's just going to have a very, very good day. And that'll filter down to everybody else, too. I think Christian Kirk will, you know, have a lot more opportunities. You know, Hopkins is going to demand double teams a lot of the time. That's going to open up things for him and Fitzgerald and everybody else. But the defenses are still both pretty bad here, so I'm expecting pick the over, you know, a little bit of a shootout kind of situation. I like Vance Joseph. I think he's a smart coordinator. And he has pieces, like I like Simmons. Chandler Jones is obviously very underrated. I think he's one of the top five pass rushers in the league. Patrick Peterson still has his moments, even though he's not what he used to be. Buda Baker, I just love. Every time I watch him, he just pops out. He reminds me, he's got a little Earl Thomas in him. He just constantly pops out. He's making plays all over the place. But there's just still a lot of holes. It's not as bad as Carolina's situation, but there's a lot of holes. And, you know, they're going to give up a lot of points. So fantasy-friendly kind of game. I think it'll be interesting to watch. I think Panthers being at home, I think it's going to be something 33-30 Panthers, something like that. A close, high-scoring kind of game. In Arizona, I think they would win, but Carolina would go on Panthers.
All right. Well, that's Tim Weaver from PanthersWire.com. How can Cardinals fans follow you on social media, Tim?
Not on Twitter myself. You couldn't pay me enough to be there, but the work account is at the Panthers Wire and website PanthersWire.USAToday.com.
All right, again, that's Tim Weaver from PanthersWire.USAToday.com, one of the NFL Wire sites from the USA Today Sports Media Group, covering the Carolina Panthers just like Cards Wire. Tim, thanks for your time. And that'll wrap up this edition of the Rise Up Sea Red Podcast, episode 272. We've covered weeks 1-4 for the Cardinals. Next week, we will be back with the next edition of the show, previewing the Cardinals' next four opponents. We'll get the New York Jets, the Dallas Cowboys, the Miami Dolphins, and the Seattle Seahawks. Until then, this is Jess Root from CardsWire.com, and this is the Rise Up Sea Red Podcast. Thanks for listening, as always. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red Podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red.